You're telling me you spoke with him? She hesitates, chewing on her thumbnail and its chipped blue polish. Not directly. But I thought you knew. I thought that was why you came to see me. Imogene, what's going on here? Just please tell me what he said. It was a message he left on our machine. Last Thursday. Todd was already gone. He had an early department meeting. I got out of the bathroom and saw the machine blinking, so... She chomps on her nail again. I hadn't heard from him in so long. He used to send letters, and sometimes they got to me, but I never wrote back. Then there his voice was, coming out of the speakers. He said he wanted us to meet. On Valentine's Day, I finish. Yes, I guess it was. He told me he needed to see me, and he'd be waiting for me by the water. That was it. She shrugs helplessly. So what did you do about it? What could I do? He didn't leave a number, and I couldn't leave my husband to traipse around to every body of water in Massachusetts. I'm not so much listening to her excuses as digging through Dad's message. By the water. Did he mean the Charles River in Boston? It's not far from Good Shepherd Hospital. Or did he mean... Do you think he could be talking about Victory Island? Oh my God. Her eyes are hazel moons. I haven't thought about that place in almost 20 years. We only went once, you know. We stumbled onto it on a long drive and stayed the night in this hotel down by the shore. This silly little tourist trap. The cheapest place on the beach, I bet. The room was such a laugh. It had this Hawaiian theme. But as soon as we walked into the lobby, I knew it was the right place to be. And it was important to you guys? It was where we, decided to keep the baby. You. That was the whole point of the big long drive. To decide what to do. She nods. It was important. I even kept our old room key. They were still using keys then, you know? I bet I still have it in my jewelry box. Jesus. This whole time. The police drove out there and found nothing, and neither did Lindy and I. Then again, how could I have? I was so convinced he was running toward my mother and not holed up alone. I didn't even really look for him. Besides, the beach was our place and belonged to us, to my dad and me. At least I thought it did. The list of what I know is shrinking by the second. I want to walk right out the door and not stop until I get to Victory Island, but that would be stupid beyond stupid. It turns out I've been a fairly bad detective thus far, so I have to get serious. A good detective would get all the information she could before running off. Reaching into the bag at my feet, I extract the stone heart and place it gem side up on the kitchen table. It rolls slowly along its curve until it's tilted, winking at my mother in the chandelier light from above. Where on earth did you get that? She leans for a closer look and hugs herself, fingertips digging into her arms. From my dad? I want to know where he got it and what it means. It was my mother's, she says, and crazily my pulse skips a beat. I had a collection of these things when I was a kid. My father worked for this company. They made screws for everything. Jewelry, ovens, vending machines, just everything. They would send him to visit their big buyers, and he'd always bring one of these back for me. Geodes, I think they're called. I don't know why he started. But he went away enough that I had drawers of them. But this one... She reaches out and brushes the rind of stone around the crystals with an index finger, and it rolls on its axis. They found in her coat pocket when she died. The police thought maybe she was on her way to Fitchburg, or on her way from... I don't know. She was bringing it to you? I ask. My mother leans back in her chair. Maybe. It was too late. I wasn't there anymore, so she never found me. Dad said you took the other half with you when you left us. I did, but that I don't have anymore. It's back home. She flinches. In Fitchburg, I mean. That's where my parents are buried. I hate to ask anything else, because I'm still trying to pretend I don't care about anything but Dad, but I came all this way. Would you ever have tried to find me? I mean... I thought you were a total broken mess. But here you have this, like, perfect life. Did you just forget about me? She gives me this pitying look, and it makes me feel like the kid again. Imogene, you don't just forget your daughter. There were times when I had to fight every damn day just to be here. I wish I'd gotten help sooner. But sometimes, all I could do was... I would draw. Monsters, right? Made-up shit? I think of Lil and my mother in their tent in that tangled backyard. Of the shredded butcher paper balled up and stuffed in my garbage can at home. Silently, she rises and leaves the kitchen. After a few minutes, I think I've chased her away for good, and I'm not sure how to feel about that. But she comes back in and thumps a sketchbook down on the table. A thick cream one, much smaller than her drawing pad, bound like any book, with a deep seam down the spine. The cover's splattered with pen and paint, and God knows what else. It looks like my much-abused copy of Rebecca. She slides it across to me. I waver for a second before opening it. Inside are drawings of little girls, except they're not all little. There are babies and toddlers, and kindergarten-age girls, and school-age girls and teenagers. After studying them, I realize they're actually all the same girl, just at different ages, and they're all familiar. They all look sort of like me. Not exactly like me. The toddler is chubby and smiling, where I was thin and always looked a little angry slash creepy, thanks to the frowny mouth. The 10 or so year old has too long hair and a ski slope nose like Sidoni, and wears braids, which I never did. Dad didn't know how to braid. And the teenager is infinitely more stylish and doesn't have my kind of pear shape. They've all got thinner lips than mine. And the teenager's hands look like smoother, younger versions of Sidoni's. These drawings aren't of me, but of the way my mother imagined I might be. And there are pages and pages and pages of them. A whole book of them. I paw at my eyes with the back of my hand. Sidoni takes the book from me and slowly reaches for my arm, like she's afraid I'll jump away. Were you really honestly all right? Were you telling the truth when you said you and your dad were okay on your own? Her eyes are huge in her small face. You don't have to make me feel better. I don't deserve it. I try to think of an answer, but instead I find myself thinking of handsome forensic pathologist Miles Fay. The first thing he tells you about himself is how he can read bodies like they're books. The plot of A Time to Chill kicks off with a simple, fascinating case that Miles solves easily. One of those gambits that shows us how brilliant he is, so that when the real mystery hits, we know it's a big deal. 7 besuited businessmen are pulled from Boston Harbor on a winter night. The luxury cruiser they'd inexplicably rented for twilight sail, having sunk miles out. Though they floated for a long time, the men were A-okay when they came out of the freezing water, chatting happily with the Coast Guard aboard the rescue boat, accepting cups of coffee. They went below decks to dry off and wrap up, and every one of the 7 dropped down dead. Miles looked at those blue-lipped bodies and knew immediately that, 1, all of the men had been drugged by poisoned complimentary champagne aboard the rental boat. It later turned out, which is how they ended up in the water in the first place. 2, the men suffered from rewarming shock, wherein their icy hearts, once warmed, failed in the absence of blood. The heart can take the cold, Miles said. Sometimes it's the thaw that kills it. The bodies told him everything he needed to know, and so when a crime comes along that he can't solve by looking, that's when the mystery begins. There's no mystery when I look at my mother. The way she bites her thumbnail, the way she looks up at me through her eyelashes, or when she does turn away, the slight swing of her hair shielding her from view. In all of this, I can read the guilt and loneliness and sadness of the past, and how afraid she still is. I find every way I might hurt her. Everything I could say to smash the life she's built, to tear her apart where she stitched herself together. The possibilities scroll through my mind, and for a second, I think maybe there really are 2 kinds of girls, and I'm one of those girls. The kind who'll use what she knows to wound her mother in the worst way, to make her feel the way I felt when Dad was at his worst. But no, I really don't think I am. At least I don't want to be. I smile, making sure it's a real one and not the icy kind my best friend uses to protect herself. Yeah, we were okay. Dad, he wasn't perfect, but he was a really good dad. It's true, after all. I had more than a lot of people have, more than Sidonie had when she was a little girl. I had Lindy and Joshua Z. Scott, who loved me so much and tried to be his best for me. I think I can do this. I know it. If anyone can get him home, it's me, on my big shoulders. 18. The outside world has changed in the past few hours. Thick snow coats the hedges and caps the ornate lampposts. Slowly, Todd backs his car up through inches of powder in the parking lot. As we pull away, a curtain resettles in the glowing window of 56 Pines Road. Rather than leave me by a bench outside the Quick Mart, Todd insists on driving me all the way to Hartford, where I can catch my connection directly. It means a 40-minute drive with my mother's husband, but I don't mind so much. It's a quiet ride. Todd plugs in his MP3 player and lets me DJ, which gives us something to do besides talk about our pasts. I'm kind of over that subject anyway. I shuffle through his favorites playlist, and by the time we pull up to the bright, bright lights of Union Station, I've been introduced to the best of West Coast jazz. Now, somebody will be waiting for you in Sugarbrook, yes? He asks sternly as I collect my stuff. One more lie, just one more. Then I can take off my liar pants and pack them away, only break them out later for stuff like, don't worry, I haven't even been inside a boy's dorm room since I started college. My friend Jessa will be at the station. I promise. She knows what time my bus gets in. Good. Don't be a stranger, all right? I'd give you our number, but I guess you already have it. He pats my puffy coat sleeve, and it's only slightly awkward. Right. Yeah. Thanks. I crack the door open, then on second thought, unbuckle the straps of my bag and pull out A Time to Chill. Letting it fall open to the bookmarked page, I peel off the battered sticky note holding my place and hand it to Todd. Can you give this to Sidonie? It's her cousin's number. I think Lil would like it, you know, if they talked. He tucks it into his pocket and grins. He has a nice smile. You're really something else, aren't you, Imogene? If we had the time, I'd be in danger of liking my technical stepfather. We could compare favorite books. I could tell him about Dad's novels, and The Hound of the Baskervilles, The Woman in White, Rebecca. Oh well, maybe next time. See you, I say, and shove out of the car into the snow. At the Greyhound counter, I buy a ticket to Boston. I know I can get to Victory Island from there. Once, when Dad's car was in the shop, we rode the rail into Boston, switched from South Station to North Station, then took the Newburyport-Rockport line, just southeast of Newburyport. The tiny slice of land that makes up Victory Island juts out into the Atlantic, connected by one road to the mainland. It's maybe 5 miles from the station to the shoreline where hotels and motels overlook the water. The ticket's another $25 out of my fake prom fund, and the train ride will probably be another $10, which leaves me $23 to flag a taxi to the island, and not nearly enough to get back home again. I'd better be right. Because the next bus doesn't leave till 8:30, I've got plenty of time to sit on a bench outside the Dunkin' Donuts kiosk and ponder the trouble I'm heaping on myself. Even if I can pull this off, I almost definitely shouldn't. Lindy will think I've run away like Dad. It isn't right to do that to her. There's still the non-refundable, non-exchangeable return ticket I bought earlier that day that is set to take me from here to Framingham to Sugarbrook, though there's little chance that I could get home before Lindy. She'll be beyond furious that I left the house while grounded. Correction, left the state while grounded. I'll be spending lunchtime in her office until I'm eating mashed bananas with dentures. Risking my prime spot on the bench, I hustle over to the trash can and stuff my Sugarbrook ticket inside. With that decision symbolically made, I start rehearsing my speech for Dad, hoping I get the chance to make it tonight. Mostly, trains are great. I've taken the rail lots of times with Dad, because it's even cheaper than parking in Boston, and often quicker than driving alongside massholes at rush hour. The ride is even kind of peaceful. You can sit back and watch the trees blur by, and the fields, and the lakes like big silver coins. Trains are reliable and punctual. If the schedule says you'll be at Yawkey at 5:55 p.m., you'll probably be swimming upstream through the sweaty, noisy, beery crowds outside Fenway by 6. Except when it's really hot, and they slow the trains way down so the heat won't swell the steel and make the tracks all squiggly. Then again, they sometimes run late when it rains, and an important patch of track floods, so everything has to shuffle around the water. And of course, there are delays when a conductor's out sick, or when a passenger falls down in the tiny bathroom and the whole line backs up for a medical emergency. And when it's been snowing steadily all day, with 6 more inches set to fall before the weather clears in the early morning, sometimes the trains stop completely. I watch the big electronic boards at North Station flash, "Canceled, canceled, canceled," down the list. Most unfortunately, among them is the 10:40 train on the Newburyport, Rockport line, the last one that stops in Newburyport until the 6:30 a.m. train. Dropping down on a bench far away from the drafty track doors, I look out on the flotsam of stranded people. There's a lot of frantic phone calling, probably to best friends or parents or boyfriends. Some are stretching out on benches and in corners, buried deep inside the hoods of their coats, using backpacks as pillows. None of my, admittedly wobbly, plans involve spending the night in a big city train station. Even as I watch, it's clearing out. 2 Dunkin' Donuts and the Crazy Dough pizza stand closed. McDonald's closing. Stranded passengers flushing back out into the snow. I pull my bag into my lap and hug my knees to my chest. This is just the latest of at least a dozen rules I've broken in the What Girls Shouldn't Do Ever handbook. Still, I rip off my strawberry hat, pull up my hood, and settle in for a long night. It's just like sleeping in an airport, I tell myself, except slightly stupider. Of course, I could still head to the payphone bank and call my stepmother to come get me. She'll never let me go to Victory Island, but I can convince her to call Officer Griffin. The police can find Dad. He could be home with us tomorrow night, everything put back the way it was. And everything I have to say to him will have waited until I've lost the guts to say it, so it will never get said. We'll go on the same way we have been, till the next bad time. I bury my hands in my pockets, knocking past the geode. My fingertips find the greasy metal of the hotel room key. Sidoni gave it to me before I left Wyndham. I told her I wanted it, and she didn't complain. The plain little key is light in my palm, with a yellowed plastic tag dangling from the cap. The Tiki Motel, it reads in swirly font. A silly Hawaiian-themed motel that might be closed and condemned for all I know. Maybe Dad's in a Super 8 somewhere along the shore. Or Dad isn't at Victory Island at all. Maybe he's waiting on a bench by a random duck pond in Malden. Or, Jesus, Miami Beach. But no, Joshua Z. Scott, after all, is a connect-the-dots, picture-in-the-stars kind of guy. Now arriving at Newburyport. The pleasant pre-recorded voice over the train speakers wakes me up early on Thursday morning. Flinching in the glare of the just-risen sun, I slide upright against the cold window, toweling drool off my chin with my coat sleeve. Classy, Imogene. Pulling my gloves on, I squeeze down the aisle and spill out the doors onto the vaguely familiar concrete platform. A handful of shivering passengers shove roughly past me to get inside. I'm dead tired and hungry and cold, but I don't blame them. At least the snow has passed, and the blue-gray sky is clear over the deserted parking lots that sandwich the platform. Lindy must be awake in Sugarbrook. According to the train schedule, it's got to be 7:30. But then again, I doubt she went to bed last night. She's going to slaughter me when I find my way home. I've broken so many rules, girl-specific and otherwise, that I wouldn't put it past her to have me homeschooled till graduation, maybe home-colleged after that. I pick my way across the messy sidewalks, out onto Boston Way, where a few taxis idle. I knock on one window and ask if $20 will get me to Victory Island. It will. The lobby of the Tiki Motel is surprisingly spacious, but the brown speckled carpeting and flowered yellow wallpaper aren't exactly elegant. Sidoni was right. The decor is a laugh. Over the front desk is a fake thatched roof, fake tropical birds pinned in the plastic straws. Artwork hangs on the walls, pictures of the sea in every size and color frame. I'm no expert, no assistant the curator of prints and drawings, but none of it is museum quality, except for one familiar print by the luggage cart. Small fishermen in a small boat on inky waters, a wistful dream of plentiful food. It seems unlikely that the place hasn't been remodeled in 17 years, but my mother did say she knew straight away that this was the place for them. All of a sudden, it's depressing that this ridiculous tourist trap, which once meant so much to my parents and, I'm hoping, still means so much to Dad, never crossed her mind, not even after she heard his message. She really did leave us in the past. The front desk clerk has his back to me, rooting around under the desk and hasn't seen me yet, betting he won't give out a guest's room number to just any uncombed teenager. I duck down a short hallway to my left, past the elevator and to the vending machine humming away at the end. Kicking off my boots and peeling off my coat, gloves, and hat, I stuff them and my bag into the corner beside the machine. With the last few coins in the bottom of my pocket, I buy a Coke. I turn and survey my reflection in the tarnished gold doors, cloudy with handprints. I'm a static-haired, red-eyed mess, but it could work for me. Shuffling out into the lobby in my socks, I call out, "Hi, excuse me?" The clerk turns slowly. He looks exhausted, probably worked the night shift and won't be relieved till 9 or so. Hopefully he won't give 3 craps about protocol this late in his shift. So I lock myself out of my room. I shrug and smile at him, channeling my inner Jessa. I woke up and, came down to get a soda, but I forgot I lost my key card yesterday. And my dad's not answering the door. I think he's in the shower, maybe.
What room? The clerk mutters, crossing to his computer.
Oh my god, I should totally know this. 140 or 114? It's under Joshua Scott. He's my dad. His fingers skate across the keyboard.
Sorry, I don't think that's it.
Are you sure? More clicks of the keys and a sigh.
No, it doesn't look like it.
Now he's peering over the monitor at me, perhaps trying to remember if he's seen me check in. Black panic coils up around me. What if? Or, I suck in my breath, could it be under my other dad's name? Miles Fay? He could have, booked the room for us. I wait for the clerk to wave me off, but he doesn't.
I've got a Miles Fay in room 256.
Oh, thank God. I slap my forehead with my free hand. I am such a flake. That's totally it.
I'm guessing you'll want a spare key?
That would be amazing. I gush, collecting the key card from him after he feeds it through a little machine on the desk. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I grin as brightly as possible and walk away, casually sipping my Coke. Jessa would be proud, I think. Back at the elevators, I drain the soda. I could use the caffeine and collect my things. I ride up to the narrow corridor of the second floor, where the wallpaper is the red-orange of a bright, bloody sunset. Just around the corner is room 256, a dull orange door like every door, except not. The key card is in my sweat-slick hand, but I'm afraid to use it. I think it's like this. As long as you don't turn the last page in a book, you get to believe whatever you want to believe. You can have faith the good guys will win, the clearly identifiable bad guys will lose, and everyone will go home and eat spicy Italians on flatbread on their cheerfully dumpy living room sofa. I'm not living in a sunshiny state of delusion. I know this is real life,
not some story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, or Agatha Christie, or Rex Stout. Whatever's in room 256 will be in the room, whether I open the door or not. But I am so fucking scared to turn the page. When the keycard slot blips green, I ease the handle down, peering into the dark behind the door. A wall of stale heat and the pretentious, sweet, spicy smell of Jarum Blacks break over me. Carefully, I make my way across the cluttered floor to the single bed where a long lump under the sheets is illuminated in the slice of hallway light, and steady my voice. It's time to get up, Dad. While my father splashes water on himself in the bathroom, I poke the toe of my boot through the debris of empty beer cans and fast food delivery cartons covering the carpet. There are a lot more cans than cartons, but at least he's been eating. I'm reminded by my percolating stomach that I haven't, and none of the half-full boxes of rice or feebly rewrapped burgers look farm fresh. I sniff one, which has recently pulled double duty as an ashtray, then carefully pat the wrapper back in place. He emerges in a dingy t-shirt and his old pinch-kneed sweatpants. He blinks in the lamplight, and I wonder where his glasses are. His black hair is wild and sopping. Droplets trickle through the dark scruff, shadowing his cheeks and chin. As he stands there, unshaven, in sports-themed loungewear, reeking of clove cigarettes, it could almost be funny, except for how thin and grayish-pale and crumpled Dad looks, and how he eyes the covers like he'd love nothing more than to slip back under them and sleep. To stop this from happening, I sit stiffly on the bed, fisting my hands in the papery brown sheets. I've been waiting for this moment, and now I don't know how to start. Surprisingly, Dad does. What are you doing here, Imogene? It's not even a question, more like a line in a script he has to read, instead of a topic of actual curiosity. What do you mean, what am I doing here? I followed you. The clues you left me. He stares at me, almost black eyes blank. I dig through my bag, dumped at the foot of the bed, and pull out the heart. You left this for me, didn't you? To tell me where you'd gone? To tell me where I could find you? The longer the silence drags on, the more stupid my words sound, echoing in my own ears. If you didn't want me to look for you, then why did you give me the heart? His hand rasps against thick stubble as he drags it down his face. I don't know. You have to! You're the grown-up! Isn't it like your job to know what you're doing? Shrinking down onto the bed, he shuts his eyes. Maybe I just wanted you to have something from me. Why? I ask, cold and quiet. How long were you planning on being gone? He doesn't answer. The blood is sort of fuzzing out of my brain and toes and fingers, so I can barely feel the roughness of the stone or the sharpness of the crystals. Just a solid, unknowable weight. I'm your daughter. Lindy is your wife. We were pretty much falling apart. And this is what you are going to leave us with? I hold it up for him to see. Dad winces. With all my strength, I hurl the thing across the room, against the wall. It dings the plaster and tiny chips of rock fly, but the geode rebounds and thumps to the floor intact. This is nothing! I shriek. It's a stupid fucking rock! Imogene, stop! He cries. But I don't. I stomp on it with my winter boot, and it only grinds into the thin carpet. It's a story. It isn't Mom, and it isn't you, and it doesn't mean shit. So I don't want it. I don't even look so much as feel around the room for something heavy. I land on the squat brass lamp on the bedside table and heft it, knocking it off the shade and light bulb in one swipe. You'll hurt yourself, Dad protests. With shaking hands, I raise the lamp to bring the base down on the stone as hard as I can. There's a sound like splintering bone, and it caves. Furiously, I kick at the shards. Bits of crunched crystal and pulverized stone scatter across the carpet. I bring the lamp up again, but a sweaty band of strong fingers closes around my wrist. Stop, 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 he hushes. Like he's a father and I'm a newborn.
Sitting back on the bed, Dad drops his head into his hands.
Sorry, he mumbles.
Huh? He lifts his chin.
I said I'm sorry.
Good. So, I set the lamp down and rub my palms on my pants legs.
Good.
Joining him on the bed, I sit still for a minute before tipping my head against his shoulder. My nose squashed against his chest. He hesitates, then slings his arm around me, which puts this scratchy feeling in my throat.
What are you doing here, Dad?
Slowly he reaches into the pocket of sweatpants I'm positive he's been wearing for a longer stretch of time than is appropriate. He pulls out a piece of paper, one that's clearly been folded and unfolded and refolded times infinitely until the creases have become needle sharp, and hands it to me. On it is a printed photo of my mother, of Sidoni Malachi, outside her peach-colored condo on Pines Road. It doesn't look like she knows her picture's being taken. Below it, a page full of information is typed out. Phone number, address, the name of the law firm she works for, her husband's name.
Last month I hired this PI, he says. Guy I've consulted for my books a few times. Good at his job.
I don't know if I want to laugh or cry.
You're telling me you hired a detective? Like paid some other guy to track Mom down?
I remember one of the few facts of Dad's disappearance.
What did it cost? $1,500?
Almost.
He stares at my mother's picture while he speaks.
How did you find me?
Hard fucking work, and no cheating, that's how.
Don't swear, Imogene.
What are you going to do? Send me to my hotel room?
But I don't want to hurt his feelings, so I press myself tighter against him and give him the short version. Maybe I'm looking for a little admiration. A little, boy, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But I don't get it.
You shouldn't waste your life trying to save me, he says, and sighs.
I never wanted that. You don't deserve this.
I mean, I'm on school vacation, so there's that. And I did other stuff. I slept over Jessa's, played video games, lost my prom date.
He jerks backward.
You have a prom date?
No. I smile tightly into his shoulder. Keep up. We're quiet for a moment. The only sound in the room, the out-of-beat percussion of the old heating system pumping out rusty-smelling air. And then I take a deep breath of cigarettes and unwashed Dad and ask,
why did you need to see Mom so bad? You have me and Lindy. We're not enough?
It wasn't like that, he says dully.
I was scared. Your mother, she always got to me. I'd be going along just fine, and then I'd look at the calendar, and it'd be her birthday, or I'd pass a store and see her favorite color in the window. I'm not saying all the bad times were about her, but remembering her, it could get me down. And our anniversary was coming up. But I'd been so good for so long. With you and with your stepmother, I thought if I could know about Sid, if she could stop being this question mark, if I could just know, then I would be all right. Officially, once and for all. I hired the PI, and then I knew what I knew, what I never quite expected, that she was married and happy. And I kept waiting for the crash. But it didn't come.
That's a good thing, right?
But, Dad, you seem a little crashed.
He nods.
I wasn't, though. Not at first. Then I wondered, what if these aren't my real feelings? What if it's all just medication? And how would I know? Shouldn't I be feeling this? I thought that would be the real test.
You stopped taking your meds, I guess.
Okay. I don't get it. Were you afraid you were going to crash, or afraid you weren't?
Dad drops his head back into his hands.
Both. I know it doesn't make sense. I know you don't get it. I don't know how anyone could if they haven't been through it.
Like Mom has. The realization sinks through me like a stone.
That's why you wanted to find her. Not to save her or anything. Not like she needed it.
Dad, you lied about the curse, I say gently. My whole life, I've been doing things the way I thought she wouldn't, because I didn't want to be like Mom. And I thought if I tripped one time, I'd just keep falling like she did.
I shouldn't have put that on you. His breath hitches.
But if you told me the truth about how bad it was for you, maybe I could have helped you.
I don't know how. I don't know how I expected your mother to help me. I don't know how I could be helped.
It's the illness talking, I tell myself. It's not like I've never heard this before during the bad times. And Dad's right. I don't know what it's like to be sick that way. But yeah, I get fear. I get being afraid that you don't have anything to say to people, so you never talk to people. I get never going to parties because you're afraid you won't fit in at the party. I get loving the same boy for 8 years and never doing anything about it. But that's okay because part of the reason you love him is that he's always around for you to not do anything about. I get closing up your heart because you're afraid to look inside and find out it's hollow. I get choosing to be alone because you're afraid that if the choice is out of your hands, you'll simply be lonely. And alone is okay. It's almost cool in a way. But loneliness isn't just being alone. That's what my bedtime story taught me anyway. Except I'm not so sure. I think maybe fear is worse. The useless kind that doesn't help you cram for a test or jazz you up before bungee jumping, but sneaks in and strangles you. My mom was so afraid her own daughter would reject her. She never tried to find me. So she sat alone with her sketchbook. If she had been less afraid to be lonely, if Dad hadn't let me believe it was the most awful thing possible, if... Whether it's dead or alive, we can't change the past. There are a million more questions I could ask. The whens and the hows and the whys. But whatever facts I might collect, however I might chip away at the pain of this past week, there's only a single because that really matters. Because Dad isn't well right now, and there are reasons for that. But no one perfect answer. So all of the truths in the world aren't as important as this one. I want you to come home, I tell him. I thought knocking on my mom's door was the hardest thing I'd ever done. But as I sit up and look up at my dad, and he stares back at me, damp-eyed and wilting, I think this might be it. And I want you to take your meds and get help again, for me. I know it's like, if you could fix whatever was wrong by pouring dry cement. I'm not saying it right. Just, I know it's really hard. But I'm a kid. You have to be around for me and take care of me, 'cause you're my dad. And I love you and whatever.
And whatever, he sniffles. I'm not right, Boobwee.
I know. You'll come with me?
I'll come.
Okay. Oh, except I don't exactly have a car in the technical sense. Before he can change his mind or mine, I smudge the tears out of my eyes, pick up the telephone on the lampless nightstand, and dial our home number.
Hello?
A high-pitched, un-Lindy-ish voice answers cautiously.
Jessa?
Imogene fucking Scott! She screams into the speaker. Where are you? You know everyone is going batshit over here.
Who's everyone?
Your stepmother, for one, and your actual mom, and my mom, and me?
She tells me the story of last night, how Lindy came home to an empty house around 9 and knocked on the Price's door right away, assuming I'd skipped out to see Jessa. Chad was staying overnight with Omar Wolcott in his dorm room at BU, and Jessa was on a date with Jeremy. Still pissed after our fight, she'd officially gotten back together with him, despite me, or so she says. They had gone to the movies in Framingham, and by the time they emerged from the theater and answered their phones, it was after 10, under the pressure of Lindy's authority voice. Jessa folded like a paper airplane. She told my stepmother we'd been searching for Dad since the start of vacation, and in the process had found my real mother. After giving Lindy my mother's number, Jessa was promptly grounded for aiding and abetting. It was midnight when Lindy called Sidoni, and by then I definitely should have made it back to Sugarbrook Station. They compared notes and figured out pretty quickly that I was headed to Victory Island. This is when Lindy called the police.
Ugh, I groan.
As if she wouldn't, Jessa points out. You're lucky there's not, like, an Amber Alert about you. Who was called out of bed but Officer Griffin? She showed up in the early a.m. to interview Jessa and Lindy and assure them I couldn't have gotten as far as the island. Not a 17-year-old without a car. Not in this weather. I was probably stuck at a station in between, probably in Boston, and they would notify the police right away to look out for me. Lindy was to stay by the phone. When Officer Griffin left to set things in motion, it was after 5, and I was just about to board the early train from North Station to Newburyport. Lindy did not stay by the phone. After a restless few hours, she asked Dr. Van Tassel to babysit the landline at 42 Cedar Lane, with Jessa keeping her mother company. Lindy was presently headed east to Victory Island to cruise along the beach. Huh. I struggled to take this all in, while keeping an eye on Dad, now pacing back and forth in front of the curtained windows. And where's your mom? In the bathroom? I'm in your room. I was freaking out and just waiting, so I've been reading that book by your bed. Rebecca? Not super romantic. No, that's the cool thing. It's not about love, it's about obsession. Rebecca the person was horrible, but Rebecca the mystery was this fixation that almost kept this girl from loving and being loved. It's like a mystery about the dangers of a mystery, and... I noticed Dad watching me. Never mind. Not the time for this. Can you tell your mom we're okay? I should probably call Lindy ASAP. Wait, we? You found your dad? You actually found him? I smile, though she can't see. I did. Look, Jessa, I'm sorry I was so horrible, and you were all going batshit. You're a really great friend. Me too. I am also sorry that you were so horrible. See you when I'm not grounded? Yeah, she says, and laughs. We should be in our late 30s by then.
I love you, Em.
After that, the only thing left to do is call Lindy's cell and ask for her help. So I do, and she yells a little, and cries a little. And so do I. And then I ask her to come get us and take us home. 19. Because you can't lie to your stepmother over and over again, break into a hospital record storage room, drive all across the state with ill-gotten funds, skip town on a greyhound without telling anyone, spend the night in a Boston train station, strike out for the coast all on your own, and face zero consequences, I am indeed grounded for quite a while. School is allowed, as are trips to a family therapist with Dad and Lindy, and shockingly, visits with Jessa once her own punishment is lifted. But aside from seeing the ex-Sugarbrook sandpipers as they filter in and out of the Price's home, my first brush with the public comes over 3 months later, prom night. The theme turns out to be A Night Among the Stars, except the prom committee must have reached a stalemate when trying to decide which stars we'd be spending the night among. Exhibit A, when we pull up to Crystal Peak, a big glass banquet hall that's the second nicest in Sugarbrook. Cardboard cutouts of paparazzi are propped outside the entrance, crowded around the faux crystal columns, hunched behind cardboard cameras. Meanwhile, gold and silver stars dangle from the ceiling of the portico overhead. This. Chad twists around in the driver's seat of his mom's Solstice. Is the classiest goddamn soiree I've ever seen. You think they'll serve Grey Poupon? I bet that joke would be funny if we were old and uncool. Jessa stands in the back seat beside me, sliding gracefully over the side without using the door, floor-length dress and all. A block back, she asks Chad to pull over and put the convertible top down for our big entrance, then coast 15 miles per hour the rest of the way so we'd arrive unruffled. I follow through the actual door and join her, my low heels clomping on the pavement. Chad flips his sunglasses up onto his head to look at us. You girls are heartbreakers, he says, sweetly and sincerely. I blush, old habit. Jessa is beautiful. Right at home among the paper paparazzi, her plum purple dress has a deep neckline,
with a drop waist that hugs her body all the way down till just above her knees, where it flares gently out and pools around her pale gold pumps. I don't know how she can dance in it, but as Jessa demonstrated to the seizing beats of Nicki Minaj in her bedroom, dance she can. A knotted gold chain glitters below her collarbone. Her red gold hair, parted deep to the side, floats in finger waves over her shoulders. I'm wearing my Suzanne's Dress for Less purchase. Wine red, with its full knee-length skirt swinging. Fabulous Aunt Annette, enlisted as our stylist for the evening, gave me a coiled updo pinned into a side bun, a dark red lip, and a light smoky eye. And because we didn't know the etiquette for corsages versus boutonnieres, when your prom date is in fact your best friend, we're both wearing matching corsages with white roses. "Can you pick us up at midnight at Mackenzie Wynn's?" Jessa asks her brother. Mackenzie's throwing a post-prom bonfire, to which the elite of mock trial and probably half the class have been invited. "Anything for you two." Chad winks and flips his glasses down. They're mostly unnecessary now that the sun is setting, but he's still handsome and blonde, and almost as perfect as ever. "Nerd!" Jessa shouts affectionately as he drives off through an obstacle course of sparkling and tuxedoed seniors. Chad's our extra generous chauffeur tonight. Maybe because he's grateful we never implicated him in our schemes. Maybe because he felt guilty slash thankful slash confused or disappointed when I relieved him of his prom duties. Maybe because we are heartbreakers. I could spend hours unpacking Chadwick Price's motives, but that's another habit I'm trying to kick. It's getting easier. Like, Omar Wolcott asked me to come out with him to the friendly toast once I was ungrounded and released back into the wild, and when I breezily informed Chad, I did not pause to dissect the arc of his eyebrow or analyze the downward curve of his full mouth, millimeter by millimeter. And when he and Perry split awkwardly apart after 2 months of winky faces, I didn't even gloat. Progress. Personal growth. Beyond the big glass double doors of Crystal Peak, inside the big glass foyer, an actual photographer in a white tux starts to take our picture. "Wait," Jessa says, looking deeply bored. He lowers his camera while Jessa turns to me, patting her hair smooth with one palm. "How do I look?" I give her the compliment I think will mean the most to her. "You look just like Taylor Swift."
"Seriously?" she beams.
"What about me?"
"Perfect. You're so elegant. Like a sexy Asian Kate Middleton."
We wrap our arms around each other's bare shoulders, shivering a little in the overcool air conditioning inside the hall, and smile through our goosebumps.
"One more," she cries,
folding one slim, perfectly spray-tanned arm around the back of my neck and the other around my waist to dip me. I lift my lacy black kitten heel off the floor like I'm so flustered by the butterflies of love I can't keep both feet on the ground. The flash pops.
"Okay, okay," the photographer dismisses us.
We head into the main hall, where Exhibit B, a plush red carpet, stretches from the entrance across the parquet dance floor to the buffet table in back of the long room. Over the table, a Welcome Sugarbrook High banner hangs from the ceiling, midnight blue, painted with planets. Puzzling theme decorations aside, Crystal Peak is actually beautiful. Set away from the road on a wooded hill off Acorn Drive, it's surrounded on all sides by towering pin oaks, and the sun slanting through the trees casts green leaf light through the floor-to-ceiling windows. Out back is a patio where kids are taking pictures. "Want to go see?" I ask. We make our way across the dance floor, still sparsely populated because it's early. Jessa pauses to say hello to loads of people, mostly drooling boys, and I wave to a few of them. I even accept a hug from Katie Rodriguez in her sparkly, sky-blue ball gown.
"You're like an Urban Outfitters model, Imogene," she assures me.
"You too, definitely, but prettier."
"Oh my God, that's so sweet."
I don't really know her. I don't know many of them, even after 12 years in the same small schools, 12 years of going to the same pizza parties and joining the same extracurriculars. But I kind of love them in the fuzzy, glowing Barbara Walters camera filter of graduation and permanent goodbyes. I wish I'd known it would be like this. I wish I'd gotten to know them. let them get to know me. I do better at college, I promise myself. I'll have to, at the end of August, while I'm moving into my dorm room at Emerson College in Boston. Jessa will set out for the Savannah College of Art and Design in Georgia. She hasn't picked a discipline yet, but she'll figure it out. She's her own kind of genius, my best friend. Stopping at the buffet to grab plastic flutes of champagne that tastes spot on for ginger ale, we slide open the glass patio doors and go into the flushed early June air. Flattening our dresses under our butts, we perch on a bench facing west, where the evening sun bobs pink and orange over the silhouetted treetops. A few yards away, Lee Jung and his sophomore girlfriend, Cassidy Meyer, lean against the railing, holding their phones with outstretched arms and snapping pictures of themselves, kissing with the sunset behind them. Her hair is braided in a stiff, bejeweled halo. His is gelled into a black slick. Between tonguing and posing, Lee catches sight of me. He flushes, looks away, and hurries Cassidy back inside.
"Like there, but for the grace of God goes you," Jessa snickers. "He was nice. Sweaty hands, though. No taste in music. He put Chris Brown on my mix CDs."
Shaking our heads, we gulp our champagne. My cell phone vibrates inside the impractically small and beautifully beaded clutch Lindy gave me. One of the conditions of my freedom is I have to check in frequently. I don't really mind. I mean, I know I'm supposed to think it's annoying and overprotective, but Lindy says family isn't blood, necessarily. It's a thousand little choices we make every day. We choose to trust each other and forgive each other and go to the pasta place for dinner even though some of us would rather eat sushi. Dad didn't choose to be sick, but he chose to go back to therapy and take his meds and to be there for us. And maybe I didn't choose to have an around-the-corner-from-average family or to get a new stepmother when I was in high school, but I can choose to stick by her while Dad's getting better. I'm trying to let her in, like I know she wants me to. When I opened the door of the Tiki motel room to see Lindy standing there, I thought she'd run straight to Dad. She loves him, after all. But the first thing she did was pull me in and crush me against her for a long moment, muttering into my ear, "If you ever scare me like that again, Imogene May Scott, I will have you surgically attached to me." I'm glad she and Dad have each other. The text is a picture message from Dad, clearly taken by Lindy. He sits in his big red armchair, toasting with a wine glass full of fruit punch. The carton is clearly visible beside him. Below is the caption, "Enjoy your big night, Emmy. Be smart. Tell the boys you're saving all your dances for Jesus." I text back, "Safe at the prom. Enjoy your Hitchcock marathon, party animals. Love you." Jessa leans in to read over my shoulder.
"Aw."
"Yeah, we're precious. What's Jeremy doing tonight?" "Probably staring at my picture for hours without blinking." She smiles and bats her eyelashes. I want to say he couldn't possibly, unless it was taped to his mirror. Except making fun of Jeremy is such a low-hanging fruit. It's practically a potato. What matters is that he makes her happy, even when he makes her miserable, I guess. As the sun flares in our eyes, Jessa swats away a small cloud of gnats. It's a fact of life that Sugarbrook is beset by them every time the weather warms, then hooks her arm around mine.
"I'm gonna miss you, Em."
"Me too. A lot. But I'll be back for every single vacation. And until then, every painting you make can be of my exquisite face." "Yeah, and like, your first literary masterpiece can be all about me." "Oh, definitely." She pries her iPhone from her own tiny purse and aims it at me. "Want to take a picture to send to your mom?" I shrug. I don't know if we're at a selfie-sharing phase in our relationship. I've seen her once since February, the week after Dad came home, when she drove up to Sugarbrook to see him. I don't know what they talked about. They went into the office and shut the doors behind them. But it wasn't a long visit, and he seemed okay when she left. He came out and patted my cheek, then took his pre-dinner pills, while he brewed his customary 6 o'clock coffee. I finally got around to asking why he'd lied about he and Mom being married. He watched the coffee trickle down into the pot.
"I guess I wanted you to think you'd had a perfectly normal family once, even if you couldn't remember it." Pretty dumb, huh, Boo-Boo?
I swallowed and leaned into him.
Yeah, Dad.
Then Lindy came in, and I helped her chop asparagus tips into precise segments, as instructed, and the three of us sat down to eat, like every night. Lindy says it's my choice to forgive Mom, and I guess I have. At least I'm trying to, though I don't know if we'll ever be perfectly comfortable with each other. But even at the end of a mystery, everything's not perfect, you know? The dead stay dead, no matter that the murderer's been caught. The main character finds her answer, but maybe it's not the right one. Maybe the question she had in her head from the start was all wrong, and now she has to live with the weight of what she knows and what she'll never know. I mean, look at Rebecca. Even though Manderley burns down, and long after the place of all her and Maximilian de Winter's suffering has crumbled into a cold pile of ash and blackened stones on a lonely beach, it still haunts the unnamed heroine. She still dreams of it in the end of her story. Obviously, I'm just graduating high school, so it's not exactly the end of my story. I freeze a smile in place, and Jessa takes the picture. The music picks up inside, pounding out through the walls behind us. We twist around to watch our classmates drift toward the dance floor, summoned by the Pied Piper of a Kesha song on full volume. Levi Cantu waves at Jessa from the buffet table, sets his champagne down, and pantomimes his intentions with sharp sprinkler-armed moves. She turns to me, her thin shoulders swaying slightly to the beat.
We can stay out here a little longer, however long you want.
No, let's go in. The bugs are out anyway.
Yeah?
We stand and smooth our dresses down and catch sight of our faint reflections in the glass, side by side.
Are you ready? She asks. I open the door.
This is Emma Galvin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Mystery of Hollow Places by Rebecca Podos. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2016 by Rebecca Podos. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.